Hello, just a quick bit before this week's episode to let you know that we have a Patreon you can subscribe to if you like what we're doing here and you want more of it. You probably already knew that. We don't stop going on about it. What you didn't know is that you can currently get a little free trial, so you know exactly what you'd get as part of your subscription. You can head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes to get your first 7 days free. All you need to do is pick which tier you'd like a free trial of. The Biggest Mates tier is the one that has all the extras in it. And then for 7 days, you are free to listen to any episode we've released in the last 6 months. You can cancel any time or just leave the subscription rolling if you like what you find. It's charged monthly. And during any month, as part of that Biggest Mates tier, you'll get ad-free episodes of this show every Monday. You'll get a brand new episode of our new Manic Street Preacher show every month. 2 episodes every month of the Ultimate Playlist, our themed playlist show, where we talk about all kinds of different music, different artists, different genres, different eras, and 1 or 2 bonus episodes every month, depending on the length of the month. That's 2 episodes every week. There's also other tiers to trial. One that is just the Manic Show and ad-free What Is Music episodes, and another that is just ad-free What Is Music episodes. But hey, if the first 7 days are free, why not try a bit of everything? Plus, all tiers include access to the exclusive subscriber-only Discord where we discuss the shows, the bands we've covered, various music topics, and loads of other stuff, including some games that the friendly community have devised themselves. So head on over to our Patreon page now to claim your free 7-day trial. Go to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in our show notes. See you there. Do you guys know how genuinely confusing it is? Because I work on like my notes and stuff over like the course of like a few weeks and whatever. How confusing it is to log on to my Google Docs and just have a document that's called document. Because I've got so many of those. Yep. I've got so many like untitled documents and stuff like that. Yep. It's just called document. It's been a nightmare.
Yeah. I went into Google Docs and made a document called document in Google Docs.
Yeah.
A doc, doc, doc.
See, for me, it's okay because I always preface any of my notes with season number, episode number.
Oh, that's handy. Yeah. Maybe I should do that.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you right now, I won't.
I mean, spoilers, it's not really episode number because...
It's session number, isn't it, really?
It's
because
session
who knows
number.
how many how many.
And it's not even strictly that because I don't do notes ahead of like a random commentary. So... It's not even that. It's really just album number, but not really albums because B-sides and...
I was going to say, there's no way that this is 5.
No,
there's no way this is numbered 5.
No, it's
7?
7, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. Because you've got the B-sides and you've got introduction. What did you do for the Chronic Town? What did you do for the EP? It should be 8 by my reckoning. Oh, REM joke.
Oh, yeah. by my life's rich pageant.
I think I stuck something... B-sides hasn't got a note, so I think I must have put it at the end of another one. I have been known to do that from time to time. It's just sticking.
He's been known to do it.
Lucas, be honest, you didn't make any notes, did you?
I always make notes, apart from that one time when we did Futurology.
Yes.
Yes.
Anyway, hello. Welcome to What Is Music, a music podcast about music. We're a podcast that focuses on discographies in their entirety. We're doing deep dives on one artist at a time. And you join us for season 6, which is called Are We Enjoying This? A critical analysis of the history, culture, and impact of music of REM. And we're going through their entire career, album by album, track by track, and we're asking questions like, does context matter when you're listening to music? Does knowing the history of an artist affect your appreciation of their output? And this season, we're of course asking, are we enjoying this? And just to be clear, we're asking, are we enjoying this in regards to the band REM? Not are we enjoying this in regards to this, the 6th season of our podcast, which is called Are We Enjoying This? And which you may or may not be enjoying. I'm Adam Scott Glasspool. I'm a big music nerd. I'm a big fan of REM. And with me, as always, are two of my very closest friends. The first is someone who is not a huge music nerd, is maybe the least knowledgeable on music in general out of the three of us, and is just learning through this podcast how to apply critical thought onto why he likes or dislikes something and whether or not that means it's good. It is, of course, Lucas Way. And also we have someone betwixt those two places. It's Steve Murphy.
Wow.
So he'd done the softer, more Owen Wilson adjacent Michael Stipe.
That's right.
Waluigi himself,
of
indeed.
Course.
Welcome back to the podcast, gentlemen. How do you very do on this day?
Good morrow on the morrow, my morrow.
Rubber dub dub.
Jingle jangle.
Jingle jangle. I keep getting served that, and I like it every time.
Yeah. What is that? What is Jingle Jangle?
It's an outtake from the movie Role Models. Now, there's no reason you should know that, but it's very funny.
I think I've seen that film maybe one time when it, you know, was new, I'd imagine.
Great.
It's
great.
It's a good film. It's a good film. I like that.
Is it one of those things though, where the outtakes are better?
No, it's genuinely good. Anyway, on this podcast, we are exploring the entire discography of REM. In the last episode, we looked at Dead Letter Office, which is like a collection of B-sides. And this week, we are going to dissect, explore, and discuss REM's fifth studio album, Document, in order to try and figure out an answer to the question, what is music? But before we dig into the album itself, we like to look at all manner of context, outside influence, and contributing factors. So with that in mind, who remembers exactly where we left the band?
They had done a B-sides, hadn't they?
Yeah, it needed a few quid, didn't
they? They had, yeah. But what about before that, though, Steve?
But before that was Life's Rich Pageant.
Yes, which was kind of their most commercially successful album so far. 500,000 copies in 6 months. Not bad.
It took them towards the mainstream.
It did, a step into the mainstream.
They weren't yet, you know, they're not yet competing with the likes of Lil Nas X, and
Coldplay,
Ben,
Baby Gronk,
Taylor Swift,
exactly,
Lad Baby,
exactly.
But they're on the way. They're doing.
They're on
right.
the way there, and they tour in. They toured in North America only. They don't do a world tour. They did it for 2.5 months, and it's all arenas now, basically. And they round off 1986 by playing three nights at the Fox Theater in Atlanta, and that's where we left them. So we start up again. And I know we've covered some of this because we covered it in the Dead Letter Office episode, but we're going to pick them back up again at the beginning of 1987, if that's all right with you guys.
That's fine.
I do think we need a term for an arena that isn't huge.
Because arena.
Because arena could be anything from 5,000 to 20,000 people, which is a
20,000, I would say, is a stadium.
No, because the O2 is not a stadium.
No, I know it's not, but we are a small country full of half-wits. And in America, I think it's sort of slightly different. Because I saw Coldplay in the United Center in Chicago. That's 20,000 people. I'll tell you right now, it's a stadium. I'll tell you that
like
right
Madison
now.
Like Madison Square Garden. That's not a stadium. That's an arena, isn't it?
It's 10,000 people, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's definitely bigger than a 5,000. I don't know. I feel like there needs to be
what do you want? What do you want?
Yeah, what do you want?
I don't know. Clarity, because when you say they're doing nothing but arenas, that could be doing 20,000 people a night, or it could be doing 5,000 people a night, and there's 75% difference between those things.
I did clear it up on the episode that it was between 3,000 and 10,000 people.
It's still quite wide, isn't it?
It's quite a big gap. But it depends on the market. You know, they're more popular in some places than they are other places. But that's where we'll pick them up. And a couple of days after those Fox Theatre shows, they head into the studio to record just one song for the soundtrack to the film Made in Heaven, which is a romantic comedy that I'd never heard of. And they recorded a song that they'd written a little while back called Romance, which is nice and applicable, I suppose. Oh, and that session was recorded with the producer, Scott Litt. We talked about this on the Dead Letter Office episode, but from January they take a break. They work as Warren Zevon's backing band for his album Sentimental Hygiene. And they play like a few unannounced shows as support acts in Athens. They just crop up before other bands are playing, unannounced, where they kind of try out some new material that they've been writing. And those songs that they're writing are for the next album. And they're trying to figure out what they want that to be. They want to continue on the more mainstream path that they have started down. And I think they found the working relationship they had with Don Gehman to be incredibly fruitful and successful As we saw with Life's Rich Pageant, just a little smile there from Lucas as he obviously brings a frog into his mind, which is fine. It's
just, that's but I didn't derail it by bringing it up.
No, he didn't. No,
I just had a little smile to myself.
And then we all pictured a frog. Yeah. And mine is in a straw hat, overalls, and with... He's got like a straw,
little bit of reed, like cord or something. I mean, when you mentioned about a fruit, when you mentioned about a fruitful session, I immediately started thinking about do frogs eat fruit, and I started trying to think about a bit to do around frogs eating fruit. But I suppressed it all because I didn't want to interrupt your flow. Yeah. But
that's well done.
I got the best of both worlds.
The episode, did it?
I got the best of both worlds because I didn't do it, but we still got to talk about the frog.
Yeah. I'll have a think about what my animated frog looks like, and I'll get back to you.
You get back to us.
It's going to be grotesque. It's a horrible beast.
So they want to work with Don Gemmon again for this record, and Gemmon is seemingly not as enthusiastic about it, and said that he wasn't sure where this music was going. Peter Buck, who is REM, recalls it this way. We were talking to Don, but he was getting kind of cold feet. He was saying, I really want to make a record that's a huge commercial success. And as much as I like you all as people, and I like the band and the way you work, I can't hear that you're going to have a huge hit. And it wasn't a firm no from Gemmon, but obviously, as we have seen, REM are a band who like to work quickly and kind of get going with things. And so when Don Gemmon isn't available as quickly as REM would like, they just look elsewhere. Don Gemmon doesn't make a huge effort to rearrange or anything. He just says, hey, I'm not available. And many years later, Don Gemmon described that as, quote, the biggest mistake of my life. Yeah. So there you go. That's a huge amount of regret around that decision for him. Yeah. So REM turned to the producer that they had worked with most recently on that short session to record Romance, Scott Litt, who had actually been recommended by Don Gemmon. And Scott Litt began his career as an engineer in the late 70s, and he worked as a producer in the 80s with artists such as the DBs and Chris Stamey and Matthew Sweet and Beat Rodeo. Guys, so we know exactly what kind of music he likes.
Adam could have said anything there.
Any just string of words.
I've never heard of any of them. Big dollop of Who on that one. REM liked his production of the DBs. That's what attracted them to him. So I assume that they're some kind of like vaguely alternative rock band.
Yeah, the Decibels.
Yeah. There is one thing that he had done before Document that you guys would know, and that is Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves. And
I'm
you know
aware of it.
You
yeah.
do know.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah.
I'm walking on sunshine. Oh. Yeah.
I'm walking on sunshine. Oh.
Yeah.
And I start to feel good.
And so Scott Litt. and anyone got a cartoon animal for the name Scott Litt? Is that bringing up anything?
I'm thinking of just someone who's just like really fucking, he's really cool guy. I mean, I'm doing the hands, I'm doing the thumb.
You're doing the shaka.
The thumb, doing the shaka, because he's fucking lit, bro.
I'm going to be really honest with you, Adam. I haven't heard anything you said for a while, because you said when Don Gemmon had got cold feet, my mind just, there was so many
things.
Well,
that's typical of frogs, isn't it?
Exactly.
They've always got cold feet.
Cold-blooded. always next to ponds.
Famously not very sensitive to temperature changes. That's why you can boil them, isn't it? You can boil a frog.
Yes.
Yeah. If you chuck them in, they'll jump right out.
I made a film. Anyway. I made a film at uni called Boiling Frogs.
You fucking psychopath. What do you mean?
It was about the sort of slow burn of the sort of rising surveillance and that sort of thing. Because boiling the frog.
It was allegorical.
It's allegorical. Yeah. I might get a pet frog and call it Don Gemmon.
Yeah. Okay, good. This is going to be a problem. I mean, I'm sorry.
Well, do you know what?
Yeah,
Steve,
he's gone.
He never works with them again. God, it's fine.
Perfect.
Never works with them again.
That.
Because Scott Litt agrees to produce REM's fifth album. And spoilers, he goes on to produce their sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth albums.
Wow. So Don Gemmon's regret, he's like, I could have done all those and probably made a load of money.
I could have done all the really big ones.
But would they have been as good and would they have been as successful? Would they have become the REM that we know they become?
I think Document sounds like this if Don Gemmon produces it. Yeah, I think so. I think you follow a similar trajectory.
But does Automatic for the People sound like Automatic for the People if Don
Ooh,
Gemmon?
That's a good question. We'll find out in a few weeks' time, I reckon. It's kind of just like how Radiohead find Nigel Godrich and the Manics have Dave Ehringer. REM have Scott Litt for a little bit. And they decide to record the album in Nashville, Tennessee, at a studio called Sound Emporium. And they build on the techniques of recording and arranging and layering that the band had been taught by Don Gemmon. So gone are the days where they would record an album in 10 days or whatever fucking ludicrous thing it was that Peter Buck said.
They now do it in 14.
Yeah. I think it's basically 4 weeks. They work in that studio from March 31st, 1987 to May the 2nd. So just over a month of recording. And Don Gemmon said he gave them the tools and they ran with it. They were so aware of the tools, in fact, that REM get credited as co-producers on the album. Which is why I say I reckon Document turns out the same way, because some of that production is REM. Although, like, obviously, Scott Litt had his own method and process. He said, I like having a big sound, I like having bold sounds, and I like having a singer that grabs you. I wouldn't accept anything less. And while they're in the studio, Dead Letter Office is released. They mix it a bit later in May in Burbank, California, and they release a single before the album comes out this time, which I think that's the first time they'd done that. And in the US, they release The One I Love, and in the UK, on the same day, they release It's the End of the World as We Know It, parenthesis, and I Feel Fine. And then a week after that, Document is released on August the 31st, 1987 in the US. That is a quick turnaround. I don't know if you guys have noticed this. It's very, very quick.
Capitalize on the success.
That, but it's just always what they've done. Fables of the Reconstruction was 14 months after Reckoning. Life's Rich Pageant was 13 and a half months after Fables. And then Document comes out almost exactly 13 months after Life's Rich Pageant.
Have
and then, of course, in between Life's Rich Pageant and Document is Dead Letter Office.
Dead Letter Office
came out 4 months before Document. I'm going to repeat this a bunch over the next few weeks, I think, and we will go a bit more in depth about what it really means on a different episode. But if you just look at REM releasing albums and you include Dead Letter Office as one of them, which maybe you do because they had to record it and we listened to it and covered it and whatever, they released 6 records in the space of 4.5 years.
Yeah.
Which is mad. We've only covered 4.5 years of REM and we're on album number 5.
That's mad, isn't it?
That is mad, yeah.
Have a sleep. Have a little rest.
Just have a little sleep, exactly.
Give up.
Have
a rest. Can't slow down. Sorry.
The album is 11 tracks and it's 39 minutes and 51 seconds. It's a good length.
We talk about this a lot, what it's a good length. We've never really nailed down what is considered.
I think between 40 and 50, but I'm willing to accept entries out of that. Actually, this is another album that's under 40 minutes. Out of the 5 or 6, this is the 4th album that we've had that's under 40 minutes from REM. It's only Murmur and Dead Letter Office that are longer, and they're both about 44 minutes, I think.
How short is too short?
Well, I've got loads of punk records and stuff that are like 25 minutes. And I think it depends. And that's about as much as I want of like a punk album. Yeah. You know, 25 minutes is great.
It's 25 minutes, but that's 40 songs.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the albums I've been listening to in 2023, I think things like Mitski and things like that, they're like 31 minutes. And you're like, oh, that's nice. That's a good amount of time for that kind of music, you know? So I think it depends on the record. And I think 39 minutes and 51 seconds is a good amount of time for music like this.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't want it to be any longer.
Yeah, an hour would be a bit.
Oh, yeah, you'd be pushing it. But then you can't fit an hour on vinyl at this point.
Right.
Which make the vinyl bigger.
Yeah, you could. do 13 inches. Why not? But you do get, we've talked about it before, as soon as CD becomes very, very popular, suddenly bands start making albums that are way too long. And REM are no exception. Their first, like, quote unquote CD album is way too long. It's over an hour, and you're just like, come on, brutal. Come on, guys. And it's the same as Hail to the Thief is an hour long, right? And it's just like, come on, let's just cut like a couple of tracks off of that one. Yeah, yeah.
Absolution. Exactly. Wasn't Absolution like just under an hour?
It's like 56 minutes or something. Yeah, but now that they've added, with the remaster, they've officially added Fury into it, and it's over an hour, and you're just like, oh, come on, lads, let's trim, you know, 8 or 9 tracks off of that. anyway, the album, Document by R.E.M., produced by Scott Litt and R.E.M., the artwork... Ron Scarselli, and of course, heavy oversight by Michael Stipe. I have the artwork here. Let me get it. I love this. I have them all on vinyl now, so I get to do proper presentations for this season. It's lovely. It's a book, isn't it?
Yeah.
It looks like a book. Oh, is it?
Like it's opened and the REM number 5 is the back cover, you mean?
Oh. Yes, and you can see the spine there.
Oh,
the
middle,
you see?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
See, there it is. It's obviously the dimensions of a record are square, so you can see the book's front cover, its spine, and a little bit of its back cover, all on the front cover of the record. And that's just good value for money, isn't
it? Cannot parse what the artwork is.
It's a man with a camera.
But he's like a disembodied head and a bit of shoulder. Like, where's the rest of him?
So, the photograph on the cover, it's taken by Michael Meester. It's a multiple exposure picture. So, it's photos taken on top of each other. And that, the central figure, that's Michael Stipe. And he's pointing a film camera at you, like at the person looking at the cover. And laid on top of that is a photo of Stipe pointing his film camera at his car outside his house. But you have to turn the artwork sideways to make it out. Is that the way that it goes? No. That way. Is that right? No, I was right the first time.
God.
Can you see a car there? See?
A bit. Yeah.
Car. And a house, and then he's pointing a movie camera at it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's deliberately kind of like confusing. And I also think it's supposed to look like it's part of a series of books, which is why REM number 5 appears on the book's spine and the portion of the book's back cover that you can see on the front cover.
Yeah.
And of course, this is REM's 5th album. I like the cover. It's obviously of a person doing something, but you can get really close to it. And if you hadn't heard what I just told you, you still can't really tell exactly what's going on.
I thought I was being thick, and I was like, Adam's going to say I'm thick.
No, not at all.
I think it's one of their best ones.
Yeah, I think so as well. It's just classic REM nonsense to a degree, though, isn't it, as well? It's very difficult to make out.
I can't wait to hear how they fucked up the track listing on this one.
Okay. By the way, the film camera being pointed towards the camera that is taking the photo is in reference to the idea of making a documentary, right? A word that is shortened to give the album its title, document. What do we think of the title?
I mean, first of all, literally comes to mind as just like a file, like a thing. Like it was really funny to me that a rock band has an album called Document.
Like a dot doc. Yes.
Lucas, you've been very taken with the idea that they have an album called Document. Every time I mention it, you've gone, do they actually have an album that's just called Document?
It's Document. Just dot, doc.
But it's documenting.
Yeah, to document. It's like to document, the verb, to document something. But or it's a noun?
Yeah, of course it's a noun, because you would call it a document. Yeah, yeah. I think like the photo where you go, oh, it's two things overlaid onto each other. I think they're both absolutely cromulent. The album is intended...
He just desperately wanted to use the word cromulent.
The album is intended as a document of America in the previous year. And Stipe has said that it's a contraction of documentary. It's intended as a record of something. But, Steve, I'm wholeheartedly with you. It also brings to mind files, like those kind of documents. And there's something, and this might be because I've heard the album before, but there's always been something bureaucratic about that to me. And I think when you couple that with just the title of one of the songs on the album, it brings to mind a Big Brother style, we've got a file on you kind of surveillance kind of thing, which I think we'll go into when we get to the album.
Boiling Frogs.
that's the title that stuck after some other suggestions. Other suggestions were Mr. Evil Breakfast.
Different.
Not a spreadsheet.
Different. Yeah. No, not a spreadsheet.
PowerPoint presentation.
One of them was Lester Bangs, which was Peter's favourite music critic who had passed away and is mentioned on It's the End of the World as We Know It. Imagine just calling your album Lester Bangs. That's giving it a full name.
It's like me and you having an album called Terry Wogan. I don't know. I'm trying to think.
Why not? Why not? Fair, he's my favourite music critic.
I think that's a good name.
You would you? Yeah. What, Terry Wogan?
Yeah, he would. Yeah, why not? They always put up this like bit of paper in the studio that's just, or like it's on a whiteboard. It just says name your record, and anyone can go in and put a suggested title down. One of them was Skin Up with REM, which is quite funny. Yeah. That's quite funny. That would be good. And then there is one which is more directly in line with the stuff that Stipe was writing about, which was Last Train to Disneyland. Which is also a good title, I think. Peter Buck said...
He loves trains, doesn't he?
To me, America in 1987 is Disneyland. And he was referencing like the culture under the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And he said, America would be a nice piece of land if you could wipe out most of the people. Which I kind of get what he was saying, but also I think that's what the settlers did. I think that's what they thought as well. Which is unfortunate, isn't it? I think REM number 5 was the title at one point, as was Table of Content, both of which appear on the artwork anyway. Table of Content is on the back above the track listing. And here we go, Steve. The track listing for Document by REM is just normal. It's all present and correct. Oh. It's in the correct order. There's nothing missing. There's nothing added. It's just a normal track list. And it even tells you what is on each side.
It's been well documented.
Indeed, exactly. They're going for accurate recording of information here. Oh. The sides are called page and leaf sides. Again, bringing to mind like paper, like a document or a book, right?
Aren't they types of Pokemon?
Is page a type of Pokemon?
Yeah.
Okay. Is leaf a type of Pokemon?
Yeah, leaf is.
It's grass, leaf isn't it? Right? It's grass.
Oh, is it? Okay, fine. I don't know anything about Pokemon.
Yeah.
Hey, so that's kind of the artwork stuff. Hey, that's what the album looks like.
Let's go.
We should talk about what the album sounds like, okay? So let me just give you some little preamble before we maybe talk about it. REM, they headed into the sessions for Document with an idea of what they wanted to do. And when I say an idea of what they wanted to do, they actually had two ideas for what they wanted to do. Sure. And those ideas contradict one another. So number one... They wanted to move more left field than Life's Rich Pageant and create something just a little bit more avant-garde, a little bit weirder than Life's Rich Pageant. And two, they wanted to become even more direct and straightforward than Life's Rich Pageant. Peter Buck said, this time around, we wanted to make a tougher edged record. We wanted to make a loose, weird, semi-live in the studio album. Does that hold weight with the album that we have?
I think that is cromulent.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah,
I think it is slightly less sonically, it doesn't sound as accessible. Not to get too ahead of myself, but like, I don't immediately enjoy it as much as the last one. But definitely, there's more songs that I can tell are about a thing. And it's clear that it's about a thing. And then I know that it's the thing. So, and the thing is often, it's got a bit more of a statement as well. So I think 3 for 3, mate.
Yeah.
No, lovely, lovely. Do you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, I thought, first of all, I was worried it would take a dip, like Fables. I was worried, but I think I said at the end of the Life's Rich Pageant one, I'd hope it would sort of continue in that same route. And it is that, but yeah, they are clearly having...
The answer is both, right?
Exactly, because they're clearly having much more fun with this. In my opinion.
Than Fables.
Because there's some stuff on this, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting, because I think Fables sounds a bit more fun. A bit more, because we talked, didn't we, about it sounding a bit more like what we'd seen of them live, right? That energy. There's a bit more of the pizzazz.
You're thinking of Life's Rich Pageant.
Sorry, yes, I'm thinking of Life's Rich Pageant. Sorry, we're talking about Fables. Yes. Apologies.
With the one that you've erased from your memory, I reckon.
Apologies?
Because you hated it so much.
Yes, because Life's Rich Pageant definitely sounds more fun than this.
Oh, no. I was comparing to Life's Rich Pageant. I think this
sounds... But you
said
Fables.
Fucked up. So it's actually Steve who caused all the problems.
I was worried. What I said is I was worried that it would take a dip like Fables, but I thought they'd be continuing the same route as Life's Rich Pageant, which I think they are, but they are having more fun than Life's Rich Pageant. And what I mean by having more fun is that they are experimenting more than Life's Rich Pageant.
That's
okay.
Fair.
Because, I'm on board. I agree with that.
Because it's definitely less fun. It's definitely like I spoke about the fact that the last one, I think, sounded more like the energy of seeing of the live stuff we'd watched. And I was like, yeah. And this is a bit of a dip in that regard. It's a bit, there's a few more songs that I'm going to use the word droning or plodding, you know, a bit more ploddage.
Yeah, there's a couple of plodders on here. I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
And they, of course, go.
There are things on here stranger than Life's Rich Pageant. It's like weirder and twistier. It's a bit of a weirder album. But in terms of being more direct, I think the arrangements of the songs are much more distinct. Life's Rich Pageant was layers of guitar that all melded together to make like this big sound.
Yeah.
And I think on Document you can hear all the layers individually.
There's way more space on this.
Yes, and it's also much more riff focused. So even the bits that don't have vocals are like melody focused and engaging and catchy and quite direct. Whereas I think a lot of Life's Rich Pageant, there's quite a lot of strumming underneath arpeggios and stuff like that. This one's got some riffs, man. This one has some riffs that you can hum and bob along to. And the production is also very, very clear. It is just, we're past all of the production stuff now. All of the stuff that was notable where you go, oh, they've mixed this weirdly, it's gone. It's produced and it's mixed like a rock record. There's nothing that's obscured or like shrouded. That thing that Scott Litt said about having a singer that grabbed you. The vocals are fully clear across the whole record now. And I saw your little face move, Lucas, where you're just like, well, I still don't know what you're saying. But I think we've reached the point when we're now at, like, every other band.
Normal people can hear what you say.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. We have to lay that at you now rather than at the band. Whereas before, yeah, it was absolutely the band.
Yeah, but also, I recognise that the songs are about things, even though I'm still not picking up on every word, because that's just how my brain doesn't absorb words.
You get snatches of stuff.
I'm there going like, yeah, I know, I can tell this is about sort of something-ish.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a hangover from Don Gemmon, because Scott Litt said that there was no discussion about that. The vocals were mixed loud and clear from the start and nobody mentioned anything. But of course, on Life's Rich Pageant, Don Gemmon had to, like, basically, he all but wrestled Stipe to the ground to get some more audible vocals on the album. And when that was then met with critical praise and more commercial success, I think Stipe went into this record just ready to be like, yeah, that's what we're doing now. We can just build on that. We'll just do that across the whole record.
I don't think it's just Michael Stipe that has had that treatment too as well. Like, Mike Mills is so clear on this to the point where it's not really backing vocals anymore.
Yeah, there's some definite co-vocalage going on a lot of these, or duets or something. Like, not duets.
I think we've had that on most of the albums so far, There's always a couple of tracks where you're like, oh, this is basically just a duet rather than harmonies and backing vocals. I suppose because he sings different lyrics to Michael Stipe as well, you get that sense. I mean, there's one, we'll get to it, but he basically takes over a song at one point.
But it's giving him the space as well in the production, I think, and that is brought it out more. Maybe there's something different about this, what I felt anyway, in a good way.
There's something different about the whole thing. I think, like, even though it is a bit weirder than Life's Rich Pageant, we are still very firmly in like arena rock. And I think also, if there was ever a question around whether or not REM were like some kind of pioneer of alt rock, it is firmly put to bed here. This is one of the most 90s sounding albums that I've ever heard. This just is the sound of 90s alternative rock, and we're in 1987, you know?
Yeah.
There's a song on here that sounds like it could be on Gold Against the Soul by Manic Street Preachers, an album that wouldn't be released for another 6 years, you know?
Oh, which one's that? I mean...
Okay, well, you'll find out. You'll find out, won't you?
It's Symphony of Tourette.
Right. Yeah.
Patrick Bateman.
You're correct. No, it is Symphony of Tourette. That is the one that crops up on this album, I think. If I'm remembering Gold Against the Soul correctly, then it does sound like Symphony of Tourette. Yeah. If I said that this album reminds me of Radiohead's In Rainbows, what would you think I'm talking about?
I'd say Elaborate, please.
Yeah, I think you haven't got any kind of sense of what I might be like getting out or anything.
It's a tight rock record. Is that what you mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a degree of that. I think like when we talked about In Rainbows ages ago now, more or less a year, right? Didn't we do that in... Oh, it doesn't matter.
Is it November of World 22? Okay,
yeah, I'm getting my recording and release schedules mixed up again. When we talked about In Rainbows, we talked about it being a summation of everything that Radiohead had learned or dabbled in up to that point. You know, it's a rock album with ambient textures and electronic touches and just features a bit of everything that Radiohead had like done before or were known for. And In Rainbows just kind of wraps all of that up into a nice package. And I think that's what Document is for REM at this point in their career. You can kind of game it out. If you're willing to go down this road with me, what are some things that we've encountered so far from REM? Could be genre, tendencies, techniques, anything. Don't even think about Document.
Jangle.
Yeah. First thing I've got on my list, and I've made a little checklist, and I'm crossing it off now. Jangle pop. Obviously, we've heard loads of jangle pop from REM. It's on this record.
There's less, though. It's definitely less jangleage on this than prior.
There's less, but there's less electronic touches on In Rainbows than there was on Kid A. So we're still on course for my analogy here. God, I hope the wheels don't fall off this.
Inaudible lyrics, though, Adam. Inaudible lyrics.
Oblique, enigmatic lyrics. I've got.
Oh, he's got it.
And I think we've got those. Bass that's all over the neck.
Come on now.
Yeah. Obviously arpeggios. I think that goes with jangle pop. There's some economical drumming. What do you think about the economical drumming?
Just
some
really,
of it is
really good exchange rate.
So economical.
Yeah, exactly. And then I was trying to think about the different styles, and I know that REM have been like alternative rock music for as long as we've listened to them, but I think that there are subtle shifts within that, and I think they've done anthemic arena rock. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Yes.
What, cool. in this album as
no,
well?
No.
Oh, before the summation, yeah. Of course
that's
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
Kind of like a dark southern gothic vibe.
Yep, we got that.
That's here. Folk.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's here. Kind of like playing around in the fringes at the beginnings of grunge. I think we've heard before. We've definitely brought
Odd
it
Fellows.
Up. And I think it's here. Yeah, absolutely. They've always had a willingness to incorporate kind of new sounds before. You know, we've seen them play around with strings. We've seen them play around with instruments they're not familiar with. Here we get some cheeky funk. We get some free jazz. There's an expansion in percussion across the whole sort of album. They've always had a fun kind of party band energy, I think. And I think that's here.
Yep.
I think that's here. They have a propensity to do a lot of covers. There's a cover on this album.
Yeah.
So that's represented. There's a silly one. There's always a silly one, guys. There's a silly one. And then obviously like politics and punk simplicity, but pop sensibility kind of verging on bubblegum. I think I just summed up REM that we've heard over the last four records, and it's all here on this record.
I guess the difference for me is that the difference between those things, I think, is far wider in the Radiohead example. Do you know what I mean? I think sonically, those different modes that they then pulled together into a perfect 30 out of 30 album is
wider than
the things we're talking about in this collection of modes.
I'm not saying that Document is as good as In Rainbows. I'm not going to make that claim at any point, but I'm saying it's a similar thing where they've taken everything that they've learned before and try and wrapped it up and represented it in some form or another on Document.
I guess
we can pick them out as we go.
I guess what I mean for me is, as we've seen, a lot of those things I struggle to hear as clearly those more slight differences. And so
I don't know, man. You know the difference between folk and grunge.
Which one was Kurt Cobain?
Folk.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Because of the Unplugged.
Of course.
We've all seen him with the acoustic guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you know the difference between, I think, anthemic arena rock and dark southern gothic.
Yeah, I just mean, like I say, it's but they're less dramatically in each of those directions, you know what I mean?
That's true.
They're not doing the most anthemic fucking
the Benz.
They're not doing the most anthemic music you've ever heard, fucking, you know, Coldplay. And they're not, you know what I mean? The it's as wide into each of those modes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. But I do think that there's all sorts of things that reach back to their earlier works, not that much earlier, it's only about 4 years. Harken, indeed. And one of them is something that we saw on Reckoning. On the spine of the record is another title, which is File Under Fire. And I don't know if you remember, Reckoning had File Under Water on its spine. Michael Stipe claimed it was the real title, and the album had numerous references to water across the album. So in a similar way to Reckoning, Document has loads of references to fire, some very prominent. And again, we can pick them out as we go, but it's just one of the themes across the album. Did you guys pick out any other themes?
I saw a note of that. I saw probably the same note that you've also read, I would imagine, that Michael Stipe said that he considered that to be a central lyrical theme of the album. And then I've got a sub note to that just saying, what, to question mark? Because I don't...
From all fire. The times it's mentioned.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many references to fire.
Other themes...
Is mentioning a thing a lot a theme?
Yes, I think... We'll talk about it. We'll get into it. We'll get into it. We'll play Firewatch at one point. The game, the PlayStation game.
We'll play all the Firewatch.
I'd love to play Firewatch. Should we all
stream, at some point in the episode,
should we stream Firewatch for the listeners?
Yeah, why not? Why not? That's what we'll do. Hi, Adam here. I'm interrupting this episode of our music podcast to talk to you about different music. It's just all music all the time on this podcast. I want to talk to you about Small Miracles, a band from Cardiff that I really like. They're a new wave kind of band, but then they bring in all these elements of punk and glam and grunge. I mean, Talking Heads meets Pixies, The Cure meets Queens of the Stone Age, maybe that kind of thing. It's difficult to describe, which I think is the case for all of the best bands. If you're a fan of Manic Street Preachers, Radiohead, Muse, R.E.M., I mean, most of the music that we've covered on this podcast, if you like it, there's a good chance that you will like Small Miracles. And I've got some good news for you, because they are about to make their long-form debut. Having released a bunch of singles, they're about to release Live at Rockfield EP on Dirty Carrot Records. And this is an EP of four tracks that were captured in whole takes live in the studio. And they kind of showcase the range of the band, as well as that sort of tight intensity that they've kind of built their live reputation on. You don't necessarily have to take my word for it. They're playing Beneath Me right now. That's the music you can hear. Why don't I just shut up and we can hear a bit of that? I think that sounds great. That's just one of the four tracks on this EP. The EP can be streamed on all platforms, like all music can these days. But if you want to do something a little bit more special, you can search Small Miracles Dirty Carrot, Small Miracles Dirty Carrot, and you can order a copy of the vinyl of the EP. And all proceeds from that vinyl will fund the band's upcoming debut album. So that's pretty cool. But whichever way you listen to it, I hope you enjoy it. Live at Rockfield EP by Small Miracles. Go and have a listen.
Other themes could be, like, there seems to be more specific like political reference points and America and like capitalism and buying.
It's got a bit more manic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got a bit of that to it. I couldn't say if that's a theme.
I think so. I mean, one of the things that I instantly picked out was work. Work and industry, at least in the first portion of the album, because you've got Finest Work Song, Welcome to the Occupation, and then Exhuming McCarthy mentions business acumen. So I got a sense of like work and industry.
But then Welcome to the Occupation is about the other kind of occupation, isn't it?
Well, it's a double meaning.
Oh,
yes,
is that clever? Oh,
yes, indeed.
Maybe we'll talk about that in a little while.
Maybe we will. But I did start to look into the work thing a little bit, and on the back cover of the album, and on both sides of the inside sleeves, are photos of these very dramatic, like murals, which were painted as part of the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s. And the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, was an American agency that was set up in the Great Depression specifically to employ millions of job seekers, which were mostly men who were not like formally educated, to carry out public works projects. So like constructing public buildings, building roads, stuff like that. But also works of public art, like those murals. And the wages were well below industry standards in all regards. And the people who did the work remained poor and in need of government relief through other avenues. And so what the WPA was actually doing was just keeping people occupied, like working for the sake of it, so that they would be distracted from the depression that engulfed the entire country. And the WPA also kind of created propaganda about how important it is to work and have a job and work being good for the soul. And I think if you fast forward 50 years to America in the 1980s, you are firmly in the greed is good, Wall Street expansion, big business, corporation-led era of the American economy. And Michael Stipe said, the American work ethic can be a very ugly thing, but a lot of the songs on Document deal with a misunderstanding of work as a replacement for feeling or a repression of feeling. And he also said, in America, if you can't make money, they think it's because you're a failure. America in the 80s was all about working, making money, gaining status.
And buying stuff.
Buying stuff, yeah. Consuming.
Got to have loads of stuff.
And by 1987, which is when this album was recorded and released, you're in the full swing of Reaganomics, which largely hinged on tax cuts for large corporations and wealthy people in the hope, which you can also read as lie, that the leftover wealth would then, quote, trickle down to the rest of society. You've heard of trickle-down economics.
It'll right? come soon. No, it's gonna catch
us. It's on its way, isn't it?
It's a slow river. It'll catch us up soon.
We're in for a flash flood at some point, I think. And so also, I mean, that approach to the economy set the wheels in motion for the kind of wealth inequality that we are experiencing now, the stuff that we see today. And there is a lot of Reagan's America on this album. Mm. I think this album is kind of a response to it. So there's quite a bit of politics on the record. And I think that is how it becomes a theme, an overarching theme, is that it's taking place kind of in this world, you know?
Who was president after Ronald Reagan?
George Bush, the
and
senior.
Then Clinton,
then George Bush, the junior
onwards. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. I've seen Michael Stipe talk about how being in the band since the age of 19 basically politicized him, because he wasn't just seeing the things that were going on in his country, but he got to travel to Europe with the band, and he saw how other people viewed America as it was led under Reagan, and it left him just embarrassed and angry. And hey man, we weren't born, so do you want some like headlines from Ronald Reagan's presidency?
Yes, please. I'm sure it's all going to be really great
he
stuff.
He was not a crook. That's okay. Lucas's knowledge of American history fully intact.
Yeah. It's lifeblood only.
His presidency ran from 1981 to 1989, and he was the first truly conservative president that America had had in about 50 years. They'd had Republicans, of course, but Reagan was a bit further right than basically all of them. Also, I always forget this, not a politician. He was an actor.
An actor?
He was in loads of westerns. He was an actor and entertainer. So we're also seeing that American obsession with celebrity and status coming to fruition there, as well as paving the way for the likes of Donald Trump, you know? He introduced Reaganomics, which increased the gap between the rich and the poor and espoused the need for less government spending. And he left office having tripled the national debt. Refused to end the Cold War and instead chose to escalate the arms race, classic Reagan. Kickstarted the war on drugs, which actually basically amounted to a war on black youth and other young minorities. Steve, not the band.
Okay. Yeah, I realised that when he did the next bit, yeah.
He funded the Contras in Nicaragua and supplied them with weapons because they were fighting a socialist government, even though the Contras were responsible for a lot of the drugs that made their way into the United States.
We definitely talked about that on the Manic season.
I think we might have done, yeah. his presidency was widely seen as the beginning of that depressing spiral into conservatism and fundamentalist evangelical control of the government. There was a much more heightened focus on religion, and his presidency really helped move the GOP further and further to the right. That increased presence of Christianity in the administration led to him basically ignoring the AIDS crisis of the 80s, and was just basically just a huge hypocrite. He espoused the need for small government with minimal intervention. So even though he would fund right-wing fanatics to depose foreign leaders, and he would allow the police force to, quote, enforce the law by beating black teens, or he would pull the US out of occupied territory, eventually leading to an increase in terrorism against the US, he found that funding social programs that helped the poor was, quote, government overreach. So that is the that's the world that this album lives in, and I can hear the anger in the album. It's a darker tone than Life's Rich Pageant or Reckoning or Murmur. I think its tone is similar to Fables of the Reconstruction, and also it stands in opposition to all of the stuff that we just talked about. We've seen them talk like about stuff like it before. If you remember things like The Flowers of Guatemala, about the Guatemalan coup and the US involvement in that. Or, you know, we've had the Rise Up sentiments of These Days and I Believe on Life's Rich Pageant. This seems much darker, less hopeful, more fatalistic. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I think, actually, do you know what we can talk about now? Because I think that's where Fire comes in. There's a lot of fire and brimstone on this album, and there's some apocalyptic imagery, which obviously brings fire. And Michael Stipe said, the whole album is about fire, about everything you think about fire as being. Cleansing, something that destroys everything in its path. It's an element that's everywhere. The metaphorical and allegorical interpretations of fire are endless.
I forgot that they love the elements because
they love the elements. Steve,
they assigned each other the elements.
They love them. Cadmium, magnesium.
They love them.
Boron.
What did you call me?
Sulfur.
Called you a boron.
Yeah,
it's got a boring cold. Moron.
There's a scorched earth feel to the album. And I like the dual nature that he mentions there of being cleansing and destroying, because it's quite an aggressive album. But there are moments of like beauty and fun on it as well. And I think that's crucially kind of it. I think it is darker. I do still think it's quite a fun record. It's
I was going to say, like you were saying darker, and yes, the lyrical content and some of the songs are that. But I was kind of like, yeah, but like it's a bit funky.
It's not as funky as the last, is it? And that's... So
it's way funkier than
sorry,
the
okay,
last.
Funk yeah. being not the specific. Funk. Yeah, okay. I saw a thing, just talking about like the politics and the sort of, you know, having views thing. I saw a quote from Peter Buck around this album.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to what the difference is between these two things. So I'm asking Dad. I'm asking Daddy for help.
All right, that's Steve.
Peter Buck said, I don't like sloganeering, especially when it comes to something like The Clash, who don't know what they're talking about. They're fucking boneheads. People think that's revolutionary and it's garbage. So,
love him.
What are they doing that's not being boneheads? This isn't me. I'm just curious. This isn't me saying, got them, bloody REM.
So, I think the key there is the word sloganeering.
Okay, so that's kind of what I was getting at. About what, what specifically he means by that, I guess.
So that is like, I mean, they take huge influence from The Clash. We covered them on this podcast. They're a huge touchstone for us. Manic Street Preachers, wearing T-shirts that say, all rock and roll is homosexual. One of my favourite things they've ever done. And you're just like, that's great. What does it mean? Nothing. Like, it's just slogans. It's just tabloid headlines, isn't it? Yeah. You know, and there's stuff behind it. You know, it doesn't mean that it comes from nowhere, but things that like, oh, fuck, what was that line from like the first Manic Street Preachers EP? It's like NHS waiting lists will kill more people than car bombs ever did, or something like that. And you're like, yeah, great slogan. And hospital then the rest closures. Of the song, Yes, that's it. The rest of the song doesn't mention it again. Like, it's a slogan put in there to make you go like, oh, and no one knows what it means, but it's provocative and it gets the people going. And I think what Michael Stipe is doing on this album and what he does in general is that the songs are cohesive pieces and that it explores lots of angles of something, you know?
Okay, fair enough. It is a little bit holier than thou, isn't it, that statement?
Yeah, like, but that's Peter
like
Buck.
We're man. Good at like, doing all that, and you're just a bunch of idiots.
We saw him on the commentary for Life's Magic when he said, all music these days, to me, sounds like it's made by the same five guys. Yeah. You're just like, okay, man.
And again, which branch? Which branch and what are you getting? The one near me. Are you getting the milkshake?
Brighton. Yeah, the one in Brighton.
The one in Brighton.
The chips? You need to share the chips.
Hey,
it's too
the
much.
Chips are free, mate.
It's too much for one person. Chips aren't free.
Chips are free.
Chips are free, man.
Chips aren't free at Five Guys.
Yeah.
Mm.
What are you talking about? They're not free.
They're free.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Anyway, before we get going on the track by track, we normally like check in on if we had any previous experience on the albums or whatever. Guys, we're five albums in, finally, there's some things that you recognise. There should have been two whole songs on this album that you
Which
recognised.
Ones? Dos.
Doce.
Lovely.
Dear. And they are big ones as well, aren't they?
They're big ones. Yeah. They are big ones.
They're not Bad Day, though, are they?
Well, one of them is. Best.
Well, one of them is Bad Day. Yeah.
We'll get into that, but yeah, one of them actually is Lucas.
That's good.
So obviously you guys have that. Did those two just instantly stand out? Did you get a little bit of like, oh, when you heard them? And
yes, but also it was really interesting to hear these songs in context. Right. So. It was interesting to hit because they would have done this all together. It's not like they did the album and went, let's get two of our songs that are popular in the 90s.
Let's get and two put them of on our this. Big songs.
So like, well, biggest songs. It was really weird. Like I actually, they do jump out just because of the status. However, but when you have songs like, I'm not really going to go into it much, so I don't mind, like Welcome to the Occupation, you can hear The One I Love on it. Like, you're like, oh, yeah, that fits in this album. Yeah, so they fit in the album. And it's interesting where they are in the album as well. So that's cool. But yeah.
End of side one, beginning of side two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Closers and openers. Yeah. That is interesting. I was very familiar with the first side of this album and less so with the second side, with the exception of, obviously, The One I Love. Because it's...
Which one's that?
It's good.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's going to be annoying, isn't it?
Let's not make a big thing of it. Let's see if we can. We all enjoyed it. Let's see if we can move past it. Let's. In general, the 80s, before we did this, my least familiar REM era. And the one that I mostly listen to as part of like compilations or playlists. So I know the standouts, but I didn't know any of these five albums terribly well, with Life's Rich Pageant being the exception to that. And this album has what I think is an incredible run of songs at the front. So those come up much more frequently than songs like Fireplace or Lightning Hopkins, you know, so I was less familiar with those kind of things. Anyway, we should get going. Actually, on Life's Rich Pageant, do you remember how we talked about how a lot of the songs start with just snare?
Yes.
Do you remember?
Yes.
Remember we talked about this?
Yeah.
This album is ridiculous. It's, keep track of how many songs start with a snare hit. Yeah. Or a drum fill, or some kind of percussion.
Yeah.
It's genuinely, absolutely mental. Like, genuinely. I'm not even overselling it. It's insane. Yeah. let's start on the page side with the first track of the album, Finest Work Song. Snare.
What a snare as well.
Thank you. 46 seconds in and you're done with like the first chorus. Like it's just, it's direct and it's immediate. Straight out of the gate, I want to say the heaviest thing that we've had from them so far. If this was released in the 1970s, you might describe it as heavy metal, I reckon.
The devil's music.
I think exactly. Love it is. Throw up the big
rock and roll. Oh, no.
It's not an episode of the REM season until Lucas sings I Want to Rock and Roll All Night by Kiss.
It's so funny. Which,
by the way, Kiss are involved heavily in Role Models, Lucas. So maybe you should watch Role Models.
I've seen Role Models. I just thought maybe you should watch it in like 2006 or something.
Devil's music.
Rubber dub dub.
Jingle jangle.
Anyway. Heavy metal. Heavy metal. It's quite a caustic, sort of nasty guitar sound, I think at the front. And it honestly put me in mind a little bit of the Holy Bible. The kind of, if you remember like that scratchy guitar on Archives of Pain, doesn't sound a million miles away from Finest Work song. The darkness and the mood that they have going on there also reminded me of Fables of the Reconstruction as well. But it has that more confrontational energy of Life's Rich Pageant. It's not like sly or creepy. It's aggressive. And Life's Rich Pageant was actually quite aggressive, but in like a kind of bright and fun and hopeful way. And because of the sense of the darkness here, I don't know, it just sounds even more aggressive. It sounds heavier, you know?
Yeah, it's heavy. I started off disliking this. There was a bit of disappointment I had because it sounded like the 80s. Because so far, they've been heavily in the 80s and they haven't sounded like they were of that time.
Oh, this isn't the one on the album that's that, though. There's another very 80s.
Yeah, but I'm actually talking about this one. Well, but it's the huge drums. And you're talking about snares that start off the song. This sounds like an atom bomb. It's ridiculous. It is has the most reverb on Earth. It's dangerous. It's dangerous, actually.
It's the opposite of an anechoic chamber. They went into whatever room is considered the opposite of an anechoic chamber, and they hit a snare.
Yeah.
Echoic, yeah. I guess.
Yeah. Word is it still ringing out to this day?
Yeah, apparently. so I was a bit like, oh, no, it sort of sounds like other things that are like heavy metal. That's what it is. But the more I listened to it, the more it grew on me, and now I love it. And I'll tell you why. It's because it is pure groove, and I can't explain that. So that's all I'm going to say.
It does
very much.
It does have a groove to it, and it also has melody. Like the melody of the bass in the intro, the doo doo is great. And then the chorus. The chorus is hugely melodic, I think. But you do have to get through the verses.
Often for me, REM has been, I like the verses more than the choruses, and this one, don't bore us, get to the chorus. It's the opposite. It's the chorus is the bit that you want.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like that. And it's obviously like hugely deliberate. The verses are all just one chord. He's just playing the same chord again and again and again, and there's that very horizontal vocal melody. And then it just opens up in the chorus. And later on, you get harmonies and you get the increased verticality.
Isn't there a key change? Line.
There's a key there change. Into the bridge. Yeah.
There's a fucking key change. He stands up off his stool.
He does. You can hear him stand up. I think it sounds huge and it sounds aggressive and it sounds dark, but it still has that kind of classic REM melody writing. I think it's a great opener.
It sounds like an opener, and I believe, I saw a quote that Peter Buck said, he was like, this is the opener, basically, when they played this.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it also sounds like a gig opener too, you know?
They opened the...
Hit that snare, it rings out for 20 minutes into the arena, and then they start the song.
Yeah.
Do you know how they opened it? They actually opened it with like an extended intro, where they would go, dan-an, dan-an, and you do the big snicks.
I'm glad you thought that too, mate. Glad you thought that too. Yeah. The theme song to Nitro Circus.
Theme song to the Departed. It's in it about four times.
Oh, it is, isn't it?
That's Scorsese for you. I think it's three. It's three times. Yeah. Anyway, Finest Work song. I think it does a great job of setting up the tone of the album. You know you're in for something a bit darker, both in sort of sound and in themes. We have talked about Work and work ethics and the American fixation on having a job. I mean, obviously, it's just in the title, Finest Work Song. Do you guys know what a work song is?
Well, when I don't know for sure, but it sounds, I think of like people with pickaxes chopping
a chain gang,
chopping a big boulder. Absolutely. Down the side of a highway, all singing a song at the same time.
Yeah,
a chain
in the
gang.
South.
Yes, working on the railroad. I mean, it is as simple as that. It's as simple as a song you sing when you're working. But and I think, I don't know if it's the stuff we've talked about over the course of the season so far. But I mean, is that the same as you, Lucas? It brings to mind the Deep South and the chain gangs working.
Was
a
chain
of
gang? What's a chain gang? People chained
like
up,
prisoners.
Yeah, prisoners.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like prisoners. Or of course, African-American work songs, like slave work songs.
Yeah, I mean, I think of, that also. Yeah. Which neither of which is like working in the Reagan-y way of work and you'll, you know, earn, because both of them are people that are doing it sort of for nothing.
Oh, so what parallel do you think he's drawing there?
Whoa, I've just realised I've made a point by accident.
Well done. All connected before your very eyes.
I don't know if the song uses the term ironically or at least the narrator feels trapped, I think, because the rest of the song is concerned with some of the things that Life's Rich Pageant was concerned with, only it feels kind of more urgent, or maybe it just feels darker, I don't know. But Life's Rich Pageant was all about, I believe that change is coming and there is hope and our time will come. And this album opens with the time to rise has been engaged. You know, the time is now. You need to take your instinct by the reins. And there's also a continuation or like a repetition of a line from Life's Rich Pageant that I think shows how time has passed and we're in a different stage of this kind of urgent revolution now. On Life's Rich Pageant, is it I Believe? It might be I Believe, it might be These Days. I do often get those songs confused. Explain the change, the difference between what you want and what you need. There's the key. And then on Document, it's what we want and what we need has been confused.
Been confused.
And so I think it's a deeply political lyric which shows the distance that we have come from Michael Stipe saying, like, around Murmur or before
keep
Murmur.
Keep it off the stage.
Keep it off the stage. You shouldn't write about politics. Which then made me think of something else that is quite interesting. Actually, on our Twitter, on our social media, towards the beginning of this season, we were asking everyone, like, what do you think of REM? Like, are you REM fans? What are your takes on REM? And there were quite a few responses that were along the lines of, like, I love the first three albums before they went woke. You know?
Wow.
And stuff that's... A lot of people with the sentiment of, like, before they became leftists and started shoving it down people's throats, I enjoyed their music. Which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
But it is at least encouraging to know that people were taking on board the tone of the words, I suppose.
Yeah,
like
I suppose
people
so,
heard
yeah.
this and went, oh, not for
they
me
They just
then.
Disagreed with them, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cool opener. Oh, there's so much of this album. There's like little bits where I'm like, Lucas loved that, didn't he? Surely Lucas loved that. There's a bit of slap bass at the end.
There is.
Yeah.
Love that.
And this song is not the only song on the album to use it, but it's the first song to use the vibra slap.
Oh, of course. We all love a vibra slap.
Now, you know what a vibra slap is.
Anne Summers likes how that.
Nice.
Vibra slap is the... It put me in mind of Lucas saying, like, when they brought out the box in music lessons, everyone ran for a certain thing. I think I would run for the vibra slap, which is the wood
box and the ball.
With a metal thing. It's got a ball, and you hit the ball and it goes...
Oh, yeah.
You must know what that is. Do you want to hear it in the song?
Go on. Yeah. There it is.
There he is. Hang on. Lovely vibra slap.
Cool opener. It makes me feel it's I guess I mean it's like you said, it starts with Time to Rise, but it feels inspirational. It feels like, come on, get up. Mm-hmm. Let's go. We're gamers. We're insane.
We're gamers.
No, we're insane. Let's go.
I mean, like, come on, you know, like, and so like I was just like,
when this you get energized.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, it's great.
Did and you feel that energy, Lucas? Were you there?
No.
Okay,
sorry. I didn't hate. I'm not saying I don't like it. It's probably one of the better songs on the album, but it doesn't make. I wasn't fucking raring. I wasn't.
But the time to rise has been engaged, Lucas. That's a very Muse sentiment, actually.
It is. But Muse would do it far more dramatically and overtly.
Hey, I think this is well dramatic.
This is very dramatic.
It wouldn't be going, whoa!
Okay.
Also, though, doesn't. Oh, I also got a bit sad during the whole conversation around that song. So we're talking about Reagan and the inequality and all the rest of it. And the fact that, like, oh, fuck, well, it's that now, but even worse.
Same old bollocks.
And more blatant. And then I had the thought, and then you talked about having hope or something, you talked about a bit of energy or something. When's the last time you felt just a bit of positivity towards just like things might be all right?
What's the next one?
Do you want to listen to, listen to Welcome to the Occupation, I guess. Snare?
Yep, snare.
Hang your collar up inside, hang your dollar. Listen to the water still, listen to the causeway. You are mad and educated, primitive and wild. Welcome to the occupation, here we stand and here we fight. All your fallen heroes, held and died and skinned alive. Listen to the Congress fire, offering the educated, primitive and loyal. Welcome to the occupation. Hang your collar up inside, hang your freedom higher.
Oh, hang your freedom higher. That's cool. Much more of a jangly sound, last seen on Fables of the Reconstruction, I reckon. Those sort of crisp arpeggios are great. And they mix really well with... I've always assumed it's like a low guitar riff, but it might be the bass line. The doom, doom, doom.
Yeah, it's the bass, isn't it?
Doom, doom, doom.
Bass,
is it?
Yeah. Well, where else would the bass be? What would the bass be doing otherwise?
Doom, I don't know, it might be just doubling it. It might be, but I can hear something that's higher than a bass doing that same line. They might just be playing the same thing. Mm. Do you remember on Fables of the Reconstruction, the song Maps and Legends, and how I said I liked the song but not the production?
Yes.
And it just kind of killed it for me.
Yes.
If Maps and Legends had been produced like this, it would have been an all-timer. Because this reminds me of Maps and Legends.
And does.
Like, I love this production and I love this song too. I think the dynamics of it are great. That kind of like... The poppy, jangly verses are really catchy, and then it doesn't have a chorus.
No,
but the repeated section where it takes it down a notch and then it injects the drama back into the verse. The welcome to the occupation. It's great, and then there's that great instrumental bridge as well, and it comes back in with that big strummed like da ba down ba ba down. It sounds boss.
I feel like you added an energy in that reenactment that doesn't exist in the song there.
Oh, it absolutely does.
You said, like,
does.
Welcome
to the occupation, and
you pumped your fists in the air.
Yeah,
but the reality is, actually, I think it's much more of a droning, welcome to the occupation. You invoked a huge vibe there that I don't feel is present.
I feel it.
Simply because we've got a visual format and I can see you pumping your fists.
But you don't hear that. Like, you don't hear the drama in that line.
Nah, this song for me was really... I've got the word trudges here in my notes. No.
Wow, hugely wrong.
For me, trudge. It just it didn't really... I mean, you say about it sounding like Fables of Reconstruction, the Reconstruction of the Fables, the Reconstruction of the Fables, the Reconstruction of the Fables. Yes, I definitely picked up on that because I also have a note that it sounds like REM.
Yep.
But to that, I mean, it sounds like REM that I've heard prior. It sounds like the REM I have become familiar with, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like jangle in the, that sort of sound.
Jingle, jangle.
I mean, I've got that down. I really. I really love.
Why
this
is this only started coming up today? I've never heard this.
Not really sure.
I really love it, and it does. I've got down. It has all the hallmarks in REM song, but there is something special about this, and I can't put my finger on it. And I think it has to just go on the vibes thing. There is a vibe to this song that I really, really like. I like the structure is a bit odd, but when we get to, talking about energy though, Lucas, when you get to the listen to me bit at the end and he goes up that register, there is
to be fair, that bit, there's a lot of trudge before that, I think. And again, this is another one where the choruses are better than the verses for me, which again, it hasn't been typical.
What's the chorus for
you? Yeah, what's the chorus?
Well, I'm not going to try and sing it, but the bit that's like... The bit that's not man. Well, not the bit that's not got the do 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 do. Not that bit, because that's the verse.
So the bit that goes that an educated,
yeah,
primitive, welcome to the occupation. That bit,
yeah. Before it then goes do, yeah, and goes back into do.
Right,
do,
cool.
Do, which okay. I would call the verse. I mean, is that not the chorus and the verse?
I don't know. It's all kind of one thing, right?
Okay. Yeah, it doesn't have like a classic structure.
But that bit is to me the better bit. Which again, not how it's been for many, 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 many REM songs in my history.
Yeah,
in my deep and immense history.
Well, I tell
with
you
this
what,
band.
What you can take away from that is at least they've all got one bit you like. You know, at least they've all got one good bit.
And listen to me.
Oh yeah, sorry.
No. Oh, no, I meant the bit that said... Oh, it's dark as fuck, isn't it? Held and died and skinned alive. Listen
yeah,
to
lovely.
The Congress fire. Ooh, fire. Fire on the hemisphere.
Yes. Now, okay, well, so I think there's so many readings of this. I think mine is a little bit out there because I think there's definitely stuff in there about the US occupation of other territories. Of course.
Hence
I also think, hence the title... But also, I think it is also talking about work and industry, and I think the effect of that on like the human psyche. There's a bit near the beginning where he reminds you of like man's beginning before work became important, and then sort of like just drops a job on him. I mean, the "hang your collar up inside, hang your dollar on me" is a great line. Collar makes me think of jobs,
yeah,
like blue and white collar, and then the "rely on me for your money" thing. And then it switches to nature. Listen to the water still. Listen to the causeway. You are young and educated, primitive and wild. Welcome to the occupation. It's like a real, like, it's a hard cut, the welcome to the occupation thing, which, yeah, could mean the job thing, could mean welcome to us occupying your territory. And then, of course, he moves on to here we stand, here we fight, all your fallen heroes, held and died and skinned alive. Listen to the Congress fire, which Firewatch.
Yep.
But also a government in disarray. And then he talks about the cost of kind of all of this stuff. Hang your collar up inside. Hang your freedom higher. Listen to the buyer still. Listen to the Congress where we propagate confusion, primitive and wild, fire on the hemisphere below. And the repetition of primitive and wild to that time refer to the government, linking it back to like basic instincts, and then referencing the US policy of getting involved in foreign disputes is great.
Yeah, there's a double meaning there.
100%. Like, and he does it again when he's referencing American industry, and he mentions the deforestation that the industry causes, and he kind of like, we've talked about it actually a bunch now because of the, we've talked about US-owned factories in Mexico. I think we spoke about it for Life's Rich Pageant, and we spoke about it during the Radiohead season when he's talking about industry, and the lyrics are sugarcane and coffee cup, copper, steel and cattle, an annotated history, the forest for the fire, where we open up the floodgates, freedom reigns supreme, fire on the hemisphere below. Great. I think it's,
yeah,
like,
good stuff.
It's a very, very, very strong lyric, I think. And then the repeated refrain of listen to me, like it's a warning or a plea and you don't know which it is. One of his best and most lucid pieces of writing that we've had so far. And I think, personally, I think it's wrapped up into this incredibly strong arrangement. I really love it. I love the riff, the doom, 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 doom. And the way that weaves in and out of the arpeggios is great. And am I mental, Steve? Or do me and Lucas just have a difference there? Where there's some drama in the Welcome to the Occupation, the way that leads into the verses.
Yeah, it's absolutely excellent. It's my favourite thing on the album.
Yeah, it's in my highlights for sure.
Because I could, but I can see what Lucas means. It's not like I think that he's coming from absolutely nowhere.
Mm-mm.
It's got that standard kind of sound on the surf. I don't know how to put it.
It sets its tempo, it sets its mood, and it does it for 2.5 minutes, and then we're done. Like, there's not a drastic change of pace or
apart from
like that,
the sort of big belts. There's some big belts.
Yeah, the big belts at the end. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I was thinking about for your trousers.
Yeah, I was talking about.
Okay, right,
Johnny Big Belts.
Johnny Big Belts. Okay, right, yeah, fair enough. On today's episode, I'd like to talk to you about Buzzsprout, the user-friendly podcast hosting for non-techie people. I think that if this podcast has achieved anything, it's showing that literally anybody can start a podcast. Do you need any previous experience? No. Do you need top-of-the-range audio equipment? No. Do you need entertaining or insightful content? Absolutely not. But there is one thing that you will need, and that's podcast hosting, or somewhere to store your podcast and deliver them to all of those podcast places, like the one where you're listening to this now. So if you're thinking about starting a podcast, just do it. We here at Big Mates Enterprises use Buzzsprout to host and publish our podcast because it's the best and easiest way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Your show can be online and listed on all the major podcast directories within minutes of finishing your recording. That's Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Castbox, Pocket Cast, Podbean, Podcast Addict. The list goes on and on. The other thing we've found is that not only do you get useful and easy to understand statistics about how well your podcast is doing, but also that the support team is super helpful, with somebody always on hand to answer questions and help our podcast succeed. Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout to get their message to the world, and you'll get a great looking podcast website, audio players that you can drop into other websites, detailed analytics to see how people are listening, tools to promote your podcasts, and much, much more. But wait, because the more is now. Because if you follow the link in our show notes, when you sign up, it lets Buzzsprout know that we sent you. And do you know what that gets you? $20 worth of credit when you sign up for a paid plan. And that warm feeling in your stomach, knowing that not only are you on your way to podcast greatness, but that you've helped support this show too. So if you're starting your podcast, or you're looking to move your podcast, use Buzzsprout and follow our link in the show notes. Back to the episode. Okay, well, it leads into the third track, Exhuming McCarthy. Snare? What do you reckon? You reckon snare? Snare! You're beautiful. Go either way on the funky bit, maybe. Can we? I don't know what you guys would make of it.
Don't go either way. There's one way to go, and it's fun, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, good. I'm glad. I know some people have gone like, "What's that? What's that doing in there?" And it's a good question. It's a good question, because what is that doing in there? But I think it's great. Yeah, I think it's really good.
Don't mind it, mate. Don't mind
it.
That
opens with a typewriter sound. Which is actually the sound of Stipe working kind of in solitude. He spent a lot of time recording this album in the control room, just typing and typing and typing lyrics for this album, pages and pages and pages. He obviously doesn't work hugely. on the music. So while the three players are doing that, he's just constantly writing and honing and rewriting. And if he needed some peace and quiet, he'd go into his vocal booth, and it became such a constant sound over the course of recording, because people could hear it in their headphones or whatever, that at one point, Scott Litt just turned the microphone on and recorded it, and it felt like right to include it on this song. And I think that this is what I was talking about earlier in regards to document, you know, typing up a file in like on someone in a Big Brother kind of way, because of course the title is Exhuming McCarthy. And do you guys know about Joseph McCarthy and McCarthyism?
We talked about McCarthyism before, right?
Probably. I can't imagine it's a topic that the Manic Street Preachers haven't covered
yet. I mean, yeah. Big Manic's energy.
Yeah.
I mean, I know now because I've done notes for this episode we're doing. So,
did you not know about it before?
I knew of the term McCarthyism, but I'm not that well versed in
the band
sort of
McCarthy.
1950s American politics. And also, yeah. There's a band.
But there were a bunch of... Do you know what? This is my assumption of why you would know about it, and it's because that's kind of how I got introduced to it. Which is
the Beatles.
No, that's Paul McCartney. Oh. There were loads... When you and I did, like, we're in college and we're getting into film or whatever, loads of the kind of films that were coming out around that time were about McCarthyism. Have you seen Good Night and Good Luck?
No.
Have you not?
Okay, two separate films or one film?
It's one film. It's directed by George Clooney, and it stars George Clooney and Robert Downey Jr. and Jeff Daniels. And it's got this incredible cast, and it's about... and David Strathairn. And it's about the... David Strathairn. You know David Strathairn. You do. You know his face.
Schwimmer. You're talking about David Schwimmer?
No, I'm not talking about Schwimmer.
David Strathairn.
Strathairn, I think. Strathairn? You've got me questioning it now.
Nathan Statham.
Nathan Statham? Who's Nathan
Statham?
Is it
Jason?
It's Jason Statham. Who the fuck is Nathan Statham?
I truly am looking at this man's face, and I've never seen this.
You've never seen him in anything?
I've never seen this man's face in my life. I mean, apparently I have, because I've seen The Bourne Ultimatum, but
yeah,
I have no memory of that.
Starring Nathan Statham.
Starring Nathan Statham.
You'll have seen that movie about McCarthyism, I'm sure. There's loads of movies that are made about like the ones that get made are the ones that are about like the writers and actors in Hollywood who got blacklisted because people thought they were communists.
Like Trumbo.
Trumbo, exactly.
Yes.
Weird Pull. The Bryan Cranston starring Trumbo.
I've seen it. So
that's McCarthyism, I think. So Joseph McCarthy was a US senator in the 1950s, right? And he led a campaign of political repression and persecution against left-wing individuals and spread fear of alleged communist and Soviet influence on America, sometimes called the Red Scare. People got blacklisted for being communist or having communist sympathies. Bit of a witch hunt. We are deep in the Cold War at that point. But at its core, it was often just the government bringing the might of its power down onto the regular person. And I think that's the parallel that REM are drawing here. America's love of authority, America's love of being American, you know, like Reagan was big into the idea of American exceptionalism, you know, this kind of hangover. You know, they became such a huge superpower after World War II that they were like the hot shit in the world, you know. They were the only country that didn't suffer like huge economic downturns from World War II. But also how, I think this song is talking about how it's tied into kind of business and stuff. There's references to the 80s campaign to buy American, which I think Michael Stipe equates to buying into propaganda. And he's talking about vested interests and united ties. And he brings like a weird tribal aspect into the world of business. Like when he says you're sharpening stones and walking on coals to improve your business acumen. Mm-hmm. That's quite funny.
That line,
I quite like that.
Stood out so much.
I mean, yeah, for me, like, especially with REM, where I've definitely struggled more with other, than other bands to sort of start to get a grasp of like all the different songs, because I don't know, I'm not being grabbed as quickly. little things in songs stand out that make me go, oh, it's this one. And this definitely in this one, it's the one where they sing about business acumen.
Where he manages to gain business acumen.
So yeah. Funny.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, Steve, you mentioned McCarthy's a band. Is that not a band that REM have covered?
No, Mannix have covered them.
Mannix covered them. I knew we talked about the band, McCarthy.
Yeah, a few times.
Because when I saw Exhuming McCarthy started, I immediately assumed it was about the band, to be honest.
I think
they would have only just been a band at this point. I don't even know that much about McCarthy.
So all that stuff you just said about McCarthyism, I did know about all that. I guess I just didn't know that it was called McCarthyism.
It's sometimes called the Red Scare.
Yeah, of which I am familiar.
Yeah.
Because I'm scared of the colour red.
Okay. Oh. Well, that's something new for the law.
Jot that down on the wiki somewhere.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Terrifying.
Frightening.
And then of course, you're more beautiful than me, more honourable than me, loyal to the Bank of America. It's also quite a good line. It's quite a Mannix-esque sort of line. But again, wrapped up in one of the catchiest little pop songs I've ever heard. This one has more of that bubblegum pop sort of sensibility, the 60s kind of happy-go-lucky kind of sound.
It's the incredibly tight harmony on the to improve your business acumen. I love it.
And then, but the sharpening stones bit where the, I don't know what it is, it's a keyboard, it might be flutes or something, where they're going doot.
Yeah, that doot, doot. That. And when I said to Steve earlier, there's a song on the album that sounds more 80s. This sounds 80s, in my opinion. That, like,
it's a different 80s.
Do you know what I mean? It sounds like synth, like cheese sort of thing.
Yes. Which it isn't. I think it's just a keyboard or something like that.
Is a keyboard not a synth?
I had a keyboard when I was a kid. That when you turned on, like, fans would whir up and like air would suck through it, and the keys would change the air. But it was electric.
Yeah, but it would
be like, hah.
Fucking hell, really?
I kind of want that back.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah, let's put that on something. I mean, it would just be so loud because it was just like you turn it on, it would whir up. Interesting. Anyway, I think it's horns. I think that noise isn't synth, it's horns.
I don't think it is.
There's an organ at least.
I think it's an organ or something like that. The only reason I think it's not horns is because there aren't any horns on this album. There is one saxophone. And
there's a saxophone in this album, is there?
Oh, yeah, yes, absolutely. Oh,
the Christmas song, yeah.
It's quite a jaunty saxophone, but they are playing the same bit. You can hear it going rrp, 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 underneath the same thing.
Yeah.
And it just adds that sort of, it lends a bit of humour to it because it's quite upbeat. And then obviously it keeps slinking into this cheeky little funk bit. It's a very cheeky guitar. Great bass. Excellent use of the bongos and some lovely tambourine in other bits as
more
well.
More is more. All the things. The Lauryn Hill instrument collection.
Well, then they're like, let's chuck some spoken word in too, just for, you know.
There is a lovely little Manic Street Preachers-esque section in the middle.
I was gonna say it's a bit Manic. But again, it's not, because Mannix came later, so...
Yeah, absolutely. It's an actual recording from the McCarthy hearings of another senator berating McCarthy for his line of questioning. I had to look it up. It's the one thing I looked up. He says, "Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?" Which I think, you know, it's cool. There's loads of references to specific events and... political philosophies and cartoons from the 50s that lampooned McCarthy. It's quite a dense lyric. My favorite bit is the bit that goes, "Look who bought the myth." I think that's quite a cool, like, sarcastic sort of line. Yeah. You guys like it or not? First,
absolutely
bollocks.
Oh, lovely.
Absolutely. No, I'm joking. I love it. It's great. It makes me smile every time.
There's a song on the next album where they go even further into that bubblegum kind of simplicity.
Further, mate. More.
Yeah. And then there's a line where it's like about index funds or something. They try and squeeze something even more tedious than business acumen into a song.
The lyrics on the song that I'm talking about are just nothing. They're like so simple as to be not even there at all, I reckon. So we look forward to that.
Okay.
They have this weird ability, REM. I'm talking about the funky bit, right? Where we've never heard them do that before, I don't think. Not exactly like this. But it is still unmistakably REM. You know, they have such a strong identity that it can withstand the pushing of genre, I think.
Yeah.
We've never heard them do that. You'd still go, hey, that's REM.
I think, yeah. What you're trying to say is they get away with it.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I'm not saying that, though, because there's times where they do stuff like that and they don't get away with it.
Oh, okay.
There's some stuff coming up, mate, that they absolutely do not fucking get away with and should never have attempted.
Oh, God.
But, yeah, there's just it's unmistakably REM.
It's the hip-hop track.
Mate, that's what I'm thinking of. Yes, that is one of the things I'm thinking of. But it's not a hip hop track. It's a hip hop section in one of their songs, and it's just
okay.
It's dire. It's absolute work, and it opens the album as well. And it's brutal. It's brutal.
Okay. I mean, we've all seen him with the sideways cap. So
yeah, well, of course.
You know.
Anyway, right. Disturbance at the Heron House. Big snare. Yeah. Big snare.
4 for 4 so far.
4 for 4.
Love that main riff. The doom 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 reminded me of Green Grow the Rushes, which I really love. It is just a really nice little vibe, this. And the monkeys.
They sing about monkeys. and that's funny because monkeys are funny, aren't they?
Yeah.
One of them must surely be the monkeys, spelt double E. Like, it must be. Like,
Which one?
I don't know.
I don't actually know what the context is in the actual lyrics.
They're numbering the monkeys. The monkeys and the monkeys. I've never heard a song so many times mention monkeys.
Well, that's not true. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys.
I reckon this mentions monkeys more time.
But people say they monkey around.
So maybe it's just... Maybe it just means there's a lot of monkeys. Like, maybe there's someone standing.
Them.
Yeah, he's going, we've got monkeys, we've got monkeys, we've got monkeys.
Come on down to the Heron House. Which is
it's all monkeys all the time.
Don't pay attention to the title.
It's all no herons all the time at the Heron House. Got any herons? What's that? Monkeys.
The disturbance is there's too many monkeys here. That's why there's a disturbance. They've got all the fucking herons.
Stipe says that this was his take on George Orwell's Animal Farm. But maybe,
for him,
it's like Monkey Zoo.
Monkey World. Yeah,
Monkey House. Monkey World. I think he'd been watching Dunstan Checks In.
We've all seen Dunstan. It wasn't out yet, but he was watching it.
He got a pre-release copy. He was reading the script for Dunstan Checks In before he decided to produce it himself. And he was like, God, there's a lot of monkeys in this. He didn't understand the script, it's just one monkey. Yeah. But he turned the page and he'd go, oh, it's another monkey.
Dunstan Checks In. Dunstan Checks In. No monkeys in that film. Not one.
Oh, it's because of chimpanzee.
He's a chimpanzee, isn't he?
Chimpanzee. No, it's not. It's an orangutan.
Okay.
Ooh.
Is it, which is an ape.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. Dunstan.
Is he an orangutan, not a chimp?
Oh, he's Scott. Such a fucking orangutan, mate. You fucking look at
I'm
that
I'm on pictures.
Ginger.
I'm on pictures, and he is such a chimp. It's
that's an orangutan. You absolutely
so
joking.
Much of a chimpanzee. Oh,
you are kidding me.
He is a bit ginger, isn't he?
It's
Lucas. Give me your thoughts on Disturbance at the Heron House by R.E.M.
Again, another one that I like. And I do wonder if is me liking an REM song dependent on it having an initial hook that gets me to remember it early. And so then
this is the monkeys.
And so this is the one about the monkeys. And does that then help me?
You're a fucking idiot, Lucas.
But maybe Adam, that is
Adam,
the thing.
Adam, he likes it, shush.
But maybe I need a little hook that gets me on gets me sure. gets it in the old craw so that I can absorb it a bit more and listen to it. Because no, I do like this one. Yeah. I like the little cheeky guitar. I like it opens with a snare. That's unique. It opens with a snare. That's something.
That's four for four at this point. Yeah. Isn't mental. We are that riff, we are firmly into arena rock.
Yeah.
Here, right. That it has a slight sense of U2 to it. But it's just it's built to be echoing around an arena.
It almost doesn't sound enough on the album because it needs the reverberation of a giant space.
Well, I mean, the sound of the song in general actually is a bit more straightforward than the first three, I think. Yeah. I mean, it even has a guitar solo, which is not very REM. But having said that, the lyric is less easy to get to grips with than the first three, so it sort of balances out. I think the first three, you're like, hey, I'm more or less aware that these are about a thing. And Disturbance at the Heron House, it seems, maybe it's so allegorical, so metaphorical that it just slips away from me. But They're Going Wild, The Call came in at early morning, pre-dawn, when the followers of chaos out of control, they're numbering the followers of chaos out of control. But then he uses that format again later, and I really like it when he says cages and courageous, which is like a really nice turn of phrase. Yes, I've seen the Animal Farm thing, the George Orwell book, so obviously the George Orwell book is about power and class and politics, so it's in keeping with this side of the album, which I've seen the band refer to as the chaos side of the album. It's not an up-tempo banger. I really like the sound of it. It has that anthemic quality to it. And again, I don't know, like, not wholly something that we've heard from REM before. I'm struggling to think of something that's exactly like it.
It has a little flangey solo, which is something I think we've heard.
I was going to read my note out about that. The guitar solo makes me feel nice.
That's good.
That's nice. That's nice.
That is nice.
It's nice to feel nice.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I can see what you mean. It's still got a flavour of the jangliness to it, but it has a different flavour to that flavour.
It's got a different tone, but it's still distinctly REM. And Peter Buck spoke on this. He said that this sounded like a bit like gardening at night, but slowed down. And he said that they always tried to branch out as much as possible, but that their stuff always sounded kind of the same, which he considered a weakness of theirs. Which I think is an interesting thing for the guitarist of the band to say. To be like, I think a lot of that stuff sounds the same, even though we try and like branch out. And I think that is actually probably what we found, is that you get all these little avenues where they do like funk, or they do folk songs, or they do the anthemic rock of Life's Rich Pageant, or they do the jangle pop of Murmur. It still all kind of just sounds, it's all broadly very much in keeping with the kind of thing that REM would do, right? I think the important thing is, even if a lot of their stuff sounds the same, it didn't necessarily sound exactly like anything else.
Yeah.
So that's the them sounding like REM is the unique thing about them,
I think. And that's where I've struggled this season, is because you're more adept at picking up on those differences that aren't dramatic but are there. And
hey man, I've tried, because we did like the first episode of the season, we did half an hour on the history of rock music, didn't we, from like the 50s to the 80s.
Yeah.
And then we looked at like the two things that REM were bringing in. We looked at some Velvet Underground and some of the Birds and stuff. And then was it for Life's Rich Pageant that we did like, here's what the big albums of the time and stuff were. So I've tried, man. If you're not getting it from that, I don't know what to do.
No, I'm not saying from the music, other music to compare to. I'm saying that within the REM sphere.
Oh,
the differences. I'm saying, like, I struggle because I would levy the argument against them if I was being lazy of it all sounds pretty similar, because you're better at picking up and going, well, this is them doing this, and this is them doing this, but because it's not dramatic swings in either direction, like we've seen some other bands do or whatever, that's where I've struggled more this season, because it's still broadly, like you've just said, they're still broadly kind of all REM.
Having said that, if I played you two songs back to back, one was from Murmur, one was from Document, you'd be able to tell them apart, without question.
Yeah, I guess because it's quite a gentle line between those two things, with maybe a you know, some shaky bits on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to picture that in my head, because, like, you know, go back to the Manic season, I've got this like clear idea of like the first two albums, and then the Holy Bible is a big thing, and then they do and then they get popular for a couple albums, and then they shit all over it, and then they make a fucking best album you've ever heard in your life, and then, you know, yeah. And it's like all these big swings, whereas this is just kind of a fairly steady, gradual movement towards mainstream popular arena rock. Obviously not, it's not a direct line, but it's a gradual line with shaky bits.
Tell you what though, so far, I'm going to bring it up again. We've only covered 4.5 years.
Yes, man. Yeah.
They that is, you can fit the entire career that we've covered so far in the gap between the King of Limbs and a moon-shaped pool.
Yeah,
which is, I guess also, which is mad. Right? I hate that I keep comparing to other bands we've covered, but you know, it's a point of reference.
No, that's why we are covering every artist. Eventually, you'll have the vocabulary to talk about all music.
In 4.5 albums, we. In Muse, for example, went from showbiz to the Resistance.
Black Holes?
The Resistance. The fifth, though. We're on 4.5, so we're on the
right,
fifth.
Right,
album,
right, right, right. Yeah,
to
yeah.
The Resistance, which is sonic. There's a lot of swings there.
That's not that. I don't think that's as big as you think it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, maybe it's not.
I genuinely don't. I think because you're tuned in to Muse and you know about all the little deviations and stuff, I don't think that the distance between Showbiz and Origin of Symmetry, probably the similar sort of distance as it is between Murmur and Reckoning. You know,
yeah, but those two weren't the example I gave. That's what is very intentional. Because
no, I know. But then, you know, and then, you know, we go to like a bit of a darker sort of album, Fables and Absolution, and then a bit more. They start playing arenas, so they get a bit more anthemic on Black Holes and Revelations and Life's Rich Pageant, and then they start fucking around and bringing in other genres and stuff on Document and The Resistance. I think it's the same trajectory.
Yeah, I guess.
And also, Muse do that in 10 years, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, but also those swings, I guess, are bigger because, okay, not The Resistance, it's the next one, but they do like a stupid song with a fucking oboe solo and it's that jaunty, you know,
yeah,
which are very different to a metal song that they've done on earlier albums. You know what I mean? They're like worlds apart, I guess. Whereas, like you said, everything REM has stuck within, it is still firmly REM, but then all the stuff that Muse did is firmly Muse, isn't it?
I think it's very easy to get bogged down in number of albums and not think about amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if we include the second law, for Muse, that's 12 years. Is that right? Between Showbiz and the second law?
13.
So, you know, at REM, 13 years after their debut, don't sound anything like their debut.
What album number are they at that point?
9, I think.
Fuck me.
They churn them out. That's the thing. But that's why you don't see such huge gaps between each of their albums, is because we've done an album a year. We've done an album in 83, 84, 85, 86, and 87. And do you know what? They released their next album in 1988. Like, it's... So you get 5 albums... you get 6 albums in 5.5 years or something. So it's you know... a lot of bands these days take more time. And they have 3 years between albums to think, how do we want to change our sound? You know, what we're doing. REM are like, we want to release something every calendar year.
Well, yeah, you could almost say you're hearing the process.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost you're like hearing you're hearing the process that could get from A to B. You're hearing 100%. You're hearing B. Wait, no. To get from A to C, but you're
A
hearing
and a half.
B.
Oh.
A.5. Yeah.
Yeah, I reckon that would do.
All right, great. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode then. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We got quite far. How far do you think we got into Document? I wonder.
I wonder
these days. Let's dedicate the episode, huh? Gertrude Tenderloin, this is your episode. Do with it what you will. If you want me to ship it to you in a box made entirely of uranium, I'll make it happen. This is the podcast that gets things done. That's always been our slogan. It's always been our slogan, hasn't it? The podcast that gets things done.
Yeah, that slogan, is it?
So we'll be using that. Yeah, we'll be using that everywhere from now on, yeah? I think. Anyway, Thank you very much to everybody who listened. Our next episode is out next Monday. We're going to continue and conclude our deep dive into REM's fifth album, Document. But come and let us know what you think of everything that we've talked about so far. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at What Is Music Pod, TikTok at What Is Music. And if you want to send in something a little bit longer, maybe have us read it out on the show, you can email us whatismusicpod@gmail.com. And if you liked what you heard here and thought, I'd like to hear more of that, please do head over to our Patreon page where you'll find all kinds of extra podcast shows. One where we revisit Manic Street Preachers. So unbelievable. It's just not. One where we explore all kinds of different artists, genre, and eras to make themed playlists, bonus commentaries and music discussion episodes, ad-free episodes of this show, a pretty amazing Discord community. Head over to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes for up to 2 podcast episodes every single week. There are also other ways you can support us if you'd like to. You could buy some of our merchandise over at whatismusicpod.redbubble.com or send us a little one-off donation over on ko-fi.com, which is ko-fi.com/whatismusic. Would you believe that I do these live every single time and they're not pre-recorded and I have to do them while the guys just look at me like I'm going like mad and that they want to die? It's crazy. The best way to support us, however, is to do what you're doing right now, which is listening to us, and you can rate the show, subscribe to the show, share it with your friends, all of that sort of stuff that podcasts ask you to do. That about does it. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. But for now, it's the end of the episode as we know it, and I feel...
Christmas.
Christmas.
Yeah? Listen.